underway, and let's get out of here if we can when we're ready to do that.
The opportunity to, you know, clarify.
Okay, you ready? All right. House Committee on Revenue will come to order for February 19th, 2014. We have several orders of business today, so we'll go right ahead and get started. I would like to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 1535. Colleagues, this is our first Senate bill, I think, of the session, and we don't have very many of these, so listen carefully and get the best use out of it, please.
Senate Bill 1535 comes to you, Mr. Chair, from your counterpart in the Senate, from the House, from the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. The Senate Bill 1535, describe it on the Senate side, that basically trying to clean up some language that came out of the 2013 session from House Bill 2140 and Senate Bill 351 at that time. The language is to about the local government investment pool, and most of the change you would find it in basically the end of section one. This is in the L, and on page 3, lines 21 to 34, that's the gist of the cleanup on the bill, and the cleanup is on the advice of the AG to make that language workable in the about the investment pool for local governments.
Very good. Mr. Salvaggio.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio from the State Treasurer's Office. Senate Bill 1535 comes to you after unanimous vote in the Senate Revenue Committee and no opposition on the Senate floor. As staff noted, it clarifies statute. After we passed the Royal We, passed House Bill 2140 in 2013, the State Treasury began work on implementing local government access to the state's intermediate term pool. Upon digging into those statutes, we have identified several areas of ambiguity and imprecision, which are things that tend to irk Treasury employees. And so we have requested Senate Bill 1535 in an effort to clear up some possible confusion and clarify particular fund references. I want to put on record that this does not change current practices in the slightest, and also that this will not impede our implementation of House Bill 2140. This is purely housekeeping, and we do not expect it to have any practical effects.
Questions for Mr. Salvaggio? Representative Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I note that, like, Section 2, for instance, concerns tribal government funds, and I presume Mr. Salvaggio has consulted with tribal authorities in this language, and they are in agreement. I would hate to have them show up later and say, but we weren't consulted.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have spoken with at the tribe's representative, one of their representatives in the building, and my understanding is that there is no opposition. I don't believe that there is an official statement of support, so I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, but that consultation has happened, and my understanding is that we are good to go.
Yeah, Representative Bence, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Michael, on line 33, page 3 of the bill, and 34, there's discussion about the entering into the investment agreement with the state treasurer, and then as a condition of investing funds in a co-mingled investment pool. So two questions, or question with two parts. The first, is there any choice other than the co-mingled investment pool? And, yeah, they're first, and then follow-up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are two commingled investment pools, I believe, that local governments will have access to. They currently have access to the Oregon short-term fund through the local government investment pool, and which is a sub-account of the short-term fund. Once the implementation is complete for House Bill 2140, they will also have access to the Oregon Intermediate Term Pool. Either one of those would count as the commingled investment pool that is referenced.
But your question is different than that, isn't it?
Correct.
Yeah. Would you say it again?
Right. I'm sorry. Is this it? Are there other pools they could enter into, or are those the only two that are available? And maybe the question would be, do they have to put the money there, or do they have a choice of holding it in some local bank someplace?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. They have the option of placing money into a local bank. They can get an investment plan approved through the short-term fund board and have additional options. There are various securities listed out in ORS 294-035 that are also acceptable investments for local governments.
And then follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please, yes.
Yeah, so that takes us back then to the entering into the investment agreement. And is that something new, or is that something that you've always had them sign? And what is the nature of that agreement, and why is it necessary?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these are not new agreements. These are something that are in current practice. I have a few of them with me, but these are for my own reference, since I'm not an expert in these agreements, but I'd be happy to provide copies to anyone that asks. We've got an agreement that authorizes the Treasury to establish an account for a particular local government, so we're not going off establishing accounts wantonly. We've got authorization to provide bank account information. We've got authorization to handle ACH debits and credits. So these are very standard requirements that we would expect local governments to not really have any problem with, since it's all procedural, and we want to make sure that the expectations of any member of an investment pool are appropriate for the nature of the pool. For example, we would not want to have a local government under the impression that they were to be using the intermediate term pool or any longer term fund as a on-demand checking account if that liquidity wasn't there. So we'll right now, and if the bill passes, go ahead and have a discussion with the customer just to make sure that they understand that there are various deposits, withdrawal and liquidity limitations on according to the pool's nature.
That's fine. We'll go to the other bill. Okay. Whatever. Yeah. Sure, please go ahead.
And this takes us back to difficult times in 2008 and 2009 when those pools were at risk, so to speak, and not because of anything we had done, but because of the situation. Upon whom is the risk is my question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these pools are typically going to be fixed income instruments. There's not the option in this particular list for a pooled fund, an optional pooled fund that's more high-risk investments. The intermediate-term pool is mostly fixed income. We get higher returns not by trading additional risk, but by trading less liquidity. That's the trade-off that we make to chase those returns. The short-term fund and the local government investment pool within that are fixed-income investments.
Follow-up.
Yes, please.
Right. Well, my question, though, is if there's a loss in the pool, who bears it, the Treasury or the local government?
That was quick.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would be the participants in the pool in proportion to their deposit.
I know you're shocked.
And the agreement so indicates?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any others? To be make it perfectly clear, there are other methods that a city or a school district could choose to invest their money than these pools that you have here.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. For the record, local governments have a wide range of options in 294-035 in which to deposit their money.
But if I have a school bus fund and I'm not expecting to spend it anytime soon, in the next 3 or 4 years, then that intermediate term fund might make sense for my district.
Mr. Chair, it very well may, and what we would want to ensure through these agreements and understandings is that the district, before placing money in a fund that is longer term, like that fund, would be well apprised of the liquidity limitations. Right. We wouldn't want anyone to be surprised that money wasn't available for immediate withdrawal.
Okay. So if they were to say to you, we're going to need X dollars out of this fund in 2 years, that would be sufficient to allow the manager of that fund to make sure that the liquidity was available in 2 years.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not the manager of the fund, so I don't want to say definitively that that sounds good, but we would have that exact discussion with the potential customer and make sure that that was an appropriate place given their demands on the money.
And I think the next question is obvious, but I'd like to get it in the record. Why would anybody put their money into a pooled fund like this? Why would any governing body of a local government do that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a question of, I think it's easier for the local governments. We get a fantastic return, and they don't need to propose a separate investment plan to the Oregon Short-Term Fund. Essentially, the function of the pool is to aggregate not only the cash and the buying power, but also the effort and administrative costs.
And do you charge a fee for this service?
Yes, we do.
Okay. All right. Other questions?
I don't have a question, but I have a comment.
Please, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In light of our discussion last week about cleaning up old, obsolete, or misunderstood language, I think this is a good opportunity to say thank you to the Treasury for working during the interim to bring forward a bill that takes care of some business left over from previous legislation and make our statutes clean and well articulated.
Thank you, Representative Berger. I completely agree with that. I would note that any new idea that we work in the legislature seems to take two additional sessions to get exactly right. So I do expect at least one more revision later based on our history. But this does look to me like it's a dotting the I and crossing the T kind of bill. Would you agree? It doesn't change anything in real terms, but the Treasury likes belt and suspenders, and this provides some of that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I have only suspenders on today, but we do like making sure that everything is nice and tight, and like you say, this does not change current practices. This is a cleaning up of ambiguities.
Thank you. If I didn't say it already, I'll second Representative Berger's comment. Anything else? Now, given the question we got earlier about the tribes, is there anyone else here who'd like to be heard today on this bill? If I don't hear from you, we assume that it's okay. All right, I don't see anybody jumping up, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill or Senate Bill 1535. Are we ready to work this bill? There's no amendments that we know about. The Senate doesn't have anything. They think we should be working on this bill. All right, it's okay if we open the work session.
It's fine with me.
All right, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1535. Representative Berger?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1535 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 1535 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Any objection to the motion? Oh, I love this. You need these unanimous votes. Motion carries. Who'd like to carry the bill? I'd be happy to do it, but I'm also very happy to pass it off to someone else who would prefer to. All right. Barnhart will carry. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1535. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1541.
This says to be heard after 9:30.
Oh, this says we're supposed to hear this after 8:45?
8:45,
yeah. I think you have the earlier version.
Okay,
of
it
the
is 8:45. Okay.
And I think that's because we posted at 8:45 yesterday, isn't that right? And it is now 8:50, so I think we're okay. And you've got
Yes, I do.
Oh, good. Okay. Great.
Morning, Chair.
Go ahead and describe for us what the bill does. And
Morning, Chair, members of the committee. This is Senate Bill 1541 to extend the sunset for tax credit for crop donation. It also would increase the percentage of the wholesale price allowed as the amount of the tax credit, and it would be applicable from January 1, 2014 through on or before January 1, 2020. As of last afternoon slash evening, we have three amendments that would increase the tax credit from the original 15% that was proposed to 20%, that's Amendment 1, 25%, that's Amendment 2, and Amendment 3, that's 30%. Lastly, I have a request for you to also review the policy purpose statement that was given in the SMS and the revenue impact statement. You have a draft one that will show you a language. So at some point, if you don't mind giving any suggestions, if you have any, that would be great. Thanks.
Very good. Let's hear from, we have four people signed up to testify, and it says they're all a panel. So let's have them come up, please. Philip Wong, Ian Tolleson, John Zielinski, and Molly, McCarter? Close enough, huh? Okay. Oh, and I'm sorry. Senator, we'll hear from you first.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Please. I didn't realize you were here, and I apologize.
Oh, I just snuck in.
Great.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Berger, and committee members. Thanks for having me here to talk about 1541. It's a farm credit or tax credit for donations to the food bank. Philip came to me in the middle of summer, and we've been working on this ever since. Built pretty good consensus with this bill. What it does, and the analogy I use is it's really hard to get folks to donate things, and this kind of what we're looking for is an incentive to get people to do that. In the past couple of years, we've had a couple of hailstorms up in our valley, and hailstorms are very they're not widespread, but they're very devastating to apples and pears, like in my district, where it'll put little potholes in the fruit and it makes them unmarkable. So the fruit sits there and rots or drops on the ground. Well, Philip and the food bank, one of the growers, I was just driving by the road and he goes, Chuck, can you help me? What am I going to do? I've got probably 800 bins of pears and they're just going to rot. Is there anything that you know that can help me and I can do something with these pears? So I called Philip on, I think it was a Friday afternoon, and by Tuesday, the farm bank or the food bank from Portland brought in bins, and we set up a deal where they could pay the grower for the cost of picking the fruit. Then Philip arranged with the local warehouses up there to store the fruit until they could get it back down into the Portland area, and then they boxed it up and distributed it. And so the other thing this bill will do, but that costs the food bank dollars, their dollars that they could have bought other produce, canned vegetables, and other foods for. So we're trying to come up with a incentive to get growers, vegetable growers, fruit growers, meat producers to donate. And I kind of liken this to, like, how many times have we all been hit up to donate to, like, Girl Scouts or your local Little League, and everybody says, well, you can get a tax donation if you do that. So you give them the money, and you never take the tax credit because it's almost too bothersome. So what, besides, I don't think this will be a huge impact to the revenue department, but it will help us to help the growers, help folks that need our food. So that's why I'm here in support, and hope you support it too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for the senator? Yes, Representative Benz, please.
Thank you. And Senator, thank you for being here. Yeah. I actually contacted one of the accountants in Ontario last night to find out what the tax treatment is of the amount that you would donate to the food bank. Mm-hmm. And his indication was that you don't get a deduction. Instead, you merely get to not include the value as income. And so okay. He explained that there is no deduction, if you will, for the amount that you might give. So his explanation was that what you're trying to support today is actually a good thing because it does create an incentive which otherwise certainly doesn't exist by virtue of the deduction. Yes. And is that consistent with your understanding?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, sir. Appreciate
you
your
Thank
attendance
you.
This morning. Now, the panel that I asked for earlier.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Philip Kennedy Wong, representing Oregon Food Bank. We're here in support of Senate Bill 1541, and we want to thank you and everyone that has worked hard on this legislation. But most importantly, this legislation isn't just about a tax credit for the food bank. It's about fighting hunger, but fighting hunger in a smart and effective way. For us, when we've looked at our resources, where our traditional food donors are, it is predominantly the food industry, and we sort of look at the food industry as predominantly three areas. We have growers, we have processors, and we have the retail, and we've been pretty effective at the last two, working to recover food that would otherwise be, brought to the waste, facilities. And we know that, the need to have a more diversified sources of food has pointed us in the direction of working more and more closely with growers in the state of Oregon and also livestock producers. And so for us, this presents a very important area where we can build relationships and at the same time support Oregon agriculture by bringing more fresh food into the system. So I'm going to keep my comments brief and sort of end it there because I know we've met with all of you and we have a great panel here that can give you more sort of better understanding and perspective from where they are coming from on this bill.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Ian Tolleson, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you for hearing the bill today. This, like what Philip said, this is a kind of a combination of both the food bank supply system and agriculture in Oregon really coming together to help the need of feeding hungry Oregonians. A lot of my members, it's kind of nice to hear as I talk to them about this. A lot of people they plan this. They want to donate, they want to help, and that's to a cost to themselves, and they're fine with that. When this tax credit sunset in 2011, a lot of people were sad to see it go, and they're happy to see it come back. And that's what the tax credit will help with those people, is to help recoup some of those costs. We're talking some transportation costs, some labor costs associated with getting the food to the food bank system. So this will really help. I think this will also help kind of more the smaller farms that really don't have the larger overhead that can do the type of things that maybe a larger farm can, and they do work in their business plan. But I'll stop there because I think it's important to hear from some farmers who do donate and have to work with the food bank and the challenges they have and how this will help. So I'll turn it over to them. Thank you, and I appreciate your time.
Chairman Barnhart, committee, good morning. My name is John Zielinski. I live and farm just northeast of Salem here. We have predominantly orchards. We're easy orchards. We also have a retail farm market where we sell direct to the public. Our business, our family, has been in the area since the 1870s. And in our current form, my two brothers, who are my business partners, and I, have given a lot of product to the food bank, both Marion Polk Food Share and, on a smaller level, SACA, Silverton Area Community Aid, is where any less than perfect, because the public is rather particular, less than perfect produce from our farm market goes to. Just from our farm market last year, we donated over 23,000 pounds of food to Silverton Area Community Aid. On our farm, it varies year to year. Much like Senator Thompson said, some years are good, some years are bad. You might have damage. A couple of years ago, we donated from our wholesale side over 80,000 pounds of pears and apples to Marion Polk Food Share. The original tax credit bill sunsetted, as you know, and that's why we're here. And one of the things that I had heard the senator mention in an earlier testimony was the original 10% hardly made it worth the time to do the paperwork. By the time attorneys are quite expensive and so on and so forth. Or not attorneys, accountants, excuse me. Attorneys are too, but accountants are expensive, and
yes.
By the time you get your tax work done, sometimes it's not worth the efforts. Oftentimes, farmers will donate anyway, and they just don't bother with the paperwork. 15% is a great thing. It's a great starting point. It's an increase. It still barely makes it worth doing the paperwork. As a farmer, I would love to see it much higher than that. 25 or 30% would be a real incentive and begin to cover some of the cost that we would incur. As the senator was talking, I also was thinking, well, he mentioned, 800 bins of pears. If it costs about $16 a bin to get those picked, transport them on a truck, do everything, you're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars. And if we can take, as a society, and give $10 credit at Goodwill for a pair of jeans that you've already worn, already had a life, and donate, we should be able to give a reasonable credit to people who are helping to feed the hungry of this state. So I hope that you will consider this. I hope you'll possibly consider a higher percentage. It would be very helpful and good encouragement to the farmers who are already willing to make these donations. Thank you.
All right. Good morning. My name is Molly McCarger. I am a fourth-generation farmer from Piermine Farms. We are just north of Kaiser. And we've been in the area for almost as long as John. We farm about 1,200 acres, and most of it, or at least half of it, is vegetable row crops for NORPAC Foods, green beans, corn, broccoli, and cauliflower. We also have sweet cherries and among other things that are non-edible. But our farm has taken a position in the last, I'd say, 6 or 7 years, 8 years, that we live in and have an opportunity to do some pretty amazing things, and I think like sustaining life is one of them. Where we are, we're in the Jervis School District. 85% of our students are free and reduced. I'm on the school board. I have 4 kids. It's difficult to see your kids go to school with friends who don't have 3 meals a day, have snacks, have access to fresh fruit and vegetables. When they go home at night, after that snack that they have in the afternoon is the last thing that they may eat that night. And it's frustrating, it's concerning to have one of the hungriest states in the nation when agriculture is one of our biggest economies here. And so I see it on so many levels, and so we've just kind of made this commitment. And so in 2012, I'll just use that as an example, we donated, I started to add it up, almost 60,000 pounds of food in 2012 in various forms. One of them is through a program called Farmers Ending Hunger that was kind of created because a gentleman saw the need. And so it has taken on, I think, a life of its own, and over the last 7 years has donated, over 2 million pounds a year from farms across Oregon. And we have used that avenue as one of the best ways. And farmers want to participate. NORPAC growers want to participate. NORPAC does. They donate part of the processing. We set aside an acre of green beans and an acre of corn every year. We grow it just like the rest of the stuff. We harvest it when we're harvesting our, you know, everything else. And then NORPAC knows what our averages are. And so they say, all right, Pure Lines, here's your, you know, bean average for the year, and this is what we're donating to Farmers Ending Hunger for you. And then they pay for part of the processing. And so the co-op does it, the farmers are doing it, and NORPAC had to put a limit on the number of farmers because we own the co-op, and not all the farmers are just as generous, and so they, you know, it's dollars out of their pocket in the end too. But NORPAC would like to be able to increase that, and I think growers would take advantage of a increased tax, well, a tax credit, but an increased one at that. There's a lot of things I could tell you, a lot of stories I could share. One of them, we started a pumpkin patch 5 years ago now, five or 6 years ago, to just kind of for fun. And we decided to donate all of the proceeds from it. And so when folks come out, you get to pick whether you want to donate your money to Farmers Ending Hunger or the Marion Polk Food Share. And it's interesting how many people put a few extra pumpkins in their wheelbarrow and where they wanted to go, and always leave the change. One year, I think we had about $1,300 in extra, just keep the change to go to these programs. But one of them is we bring kids out to the farm for these field trips, and their admission is a can of food. The first year, when I was collecting the food from the kids, I saw a can of food that had already been through the Marion Polk Food Share food bank system. That's kind of when we had this aha, you know, like something's got to be done. This is the Salem Kaiser School that was out. It's important. It's important that we feed our citizens and farmers. We can do that. Not everybody has access. If somebody ever tells you that there's a surplus of food, that the things, When groups come out to help kind of clean up fields, there's really no such thing as a surplus, because if there was, we wouldn't probably have hungry people. But I just like to just take some of those things into consideration, that there is no such thing as a surplus. Farmers want to help. We just need help to help. I'll just leave it at that. I can keep going. But if you have any questions, John and I would love to answer them.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I'm curious, since you mentioned some numbers about pairs and transports and that kind of thing. I think you said $16 to pick and transport
That would just be the picking fee alone.
Just the picking
fee. And then, you know, you'd have transportation, which another person driving a tractor, forklift operator, a truck driver, to haul 800 bins. I would guess you'd be looking, depending on the distance that they travel, probably about another $5 per bin, at least. That's just on pears. It can vary with other fruits, obviously.
If you were able to sell those pears, rough numbers, what would the price be?
If they were, in the senator's case, if they hadn't been damaged by hail, I believe the cannery price, I run our farm market, and so the wholesale part of our business is run by one of my brothers. I'm not sure the current price of canning pears. If memory serves correct, I think it's about $150 a bin.
Okay. And what about for damaged, like the ones you're actually contributing?
There's really no value in off-grade pears. Mm-hmm. Actually, the cannery, when we send our pears to Northwest Pack, which is in Vancouver, Washington, any farmer's goal is to have the highest quality possible.
Right.
For a better payback. Anything that is below canning grade, I think we only get a couple dollars a bin, because it goes just to juice. It's basically, you can't afford at all to pick and process fruit for juice concentrate. Pear juice is often used as a sweetener in natural products, but that is all a byproduct of the cannery industry. You could not possibly afford to grow for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If that answers your question.
It does, and it leads to a different one, which probably is for somebody else, not you, okay. And that is this 15% we're talking about, what is that, what's the numerator for that? It obviously isn't the sale price of the damaged fruit, because at that point it's almost worthless. It must be something else.
Chair Bernhardt, let me try to sort of not answer your question. The way that we look at it is, Oregon Food Bank Network.
Let me ask staff, because maybe staff knows the answer.
I think it's meant to be on the free market value of the good that otherwise would be sold. So that's what you use in calculating the credit amount, not the cost. It's the free market value that would go in. So getting the right free market value can be a challenge, depending on where you're selling it and which market you're trying to get the price. Correct me if I'm wrong.
And every crop is different. And so this number, I mean, to harvest pears, I don't know. We have other hand harvest. To harvest broccoli, for example, it's all hand harvested, and it is probably more than it costs to harvest pears. And so all it does is help offset.
Let me help. Mr. Chair, when a donation is made, you have to you have to provide a receipt as well at the time of donation, and the food bank. And so all a grower would have to do is just basically document how much a case of pears goes at the time of donation, for example, which fluctuates, of course. So that's why it's difficult to answer.
Right. Thank you. That's very.
I would say, those are great politically correct answers, and it was originally 10%. The bill is for 15%. I would love to see it where it would actually incentivize people at 25%, and I know that it still would be a very small impact to the budget. I think Ian and Philip could comment to those numbers better than I can, but it is pretty small. 15%, as I mentioned earlier, it's barely helping to pay for the accountant to take care of it. It's mainly an incentive to help you take care of the paperwork so that you can do the right thing and donate to the people who are hungry.
Thank you. Representative Berger?
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment. I missed part of the testimony, so I don't know if this was brought up, but Marion County, where we are, is surrounded by some of the most high-value farmland in the state and some of the most valuable farmland in the world. Mm-hmm. And if you were to drive around in it, which I do frequently, you're going to see a lot of, we heard testimony, filberts being grown. And in the past, you've seen acre after acre of nursery crop. And those are fine, high-dollar crops, but they don't feed people very well. The farmers before you are generally smaller. They deal in a marketplace that's very volatile. Food is fragile, and they cooperatively get together to process it. NORPAC is huge in our area, and it's a farmers cooperative. Their margins are very slim on these products. But on the same time, they are growing things that people really need to eat. And we're not talking big ag here. We're talking very fragile, small margin ag. And if we can help them get the food to the people that are hungry and really need it, boy, why wouldn't we? Because it is the best way to help them solve a problem that we know and recognize at the most basic level.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Other questions or comments for this panel? Very much appreciate your testimony. I would call the committee's attention to the fact that we have testimony in the OLIS from others, numbers of other people that I think are not on our list today, and I would ask you to read that testimony as well. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on this bill? Thank you very much. We appreciate
it. Thank you for your time.
And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1541, and I want to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 1535. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended and Representative Bailey be allowed to cast his vote on Senate Bill 1535.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves that rules be suspended and Representative Bailey be allowed to cast a vote on Senate Bill 1535. Is there any objection to that motion? Representative Bailey, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Bailey votes aye. With that, we'll reclose the work session on Senate Bill 1535. And we're ready to go ahead then on our information meeting, Department of Revenue reports and so forth. Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You have two reports from the Department of Revenue this morning. The first one teed up is the licensee tax compliance report. As the committee may recall, in 2009, House Bill 3082 was passed that dealt with tax compliance for occupational licensees. The department has provided updated reports since that time, beginning in 2011, and then this is just the latest update report.
Okay.
Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Deanna Mack, for the record, representing the Department of Revenue, here to talk to you about our most recent report on licensee compliance. As you can tell in OLIS, it's fairly short and sweet. You probably have read it, but I thought I'd go over it kind of in a bulleted format. The first part of the report, we talk about collateral compliance and its use in law. And generally, collateral compliance is where there's a consequence, an indirect consequence for something else other than the direct consequence of action. So usually you see that, like, someone commits a crime and they end up going to jail, but then they also have a collateral compliance of not being able to be on a jury or something like that. They typically possess three different characteristics. One of them is that in tax compliance, they apply, in addition to formal tax penalties, they rescind or deny a government-provided benefit or privilege, and they usually are enforced by an agency other than the taxing authority. So when you think about licensee compliance, that's exactly what this is. It's collateral compliance. Examples right now under federal law for tax noncompliance, you can't get a passport. Can't be part of the federal home, the FHA loans. You can't get a federal job or get a contract, and so on. In other states, there's denial of recreational licenses, such as hunting permits, driver's licenses, and then, of course, professional licenses. Oregon usually relies on monetary penalties for consequences for this behavior. However, we're learning that sometimes monetary penalties aren't enough to change. It doesn't create enough of a loss to change behavior. So licensee sanctions, what we're learning is that they do provoke kind of a term called loss aversion. And that's especially associated with a government-provided benefit to which they have become entitled to have, such as a license. So we believe that licensee compliance, that sanctions on licensees do promote fairness and equity, because we find that lots of times non-compliant businesses are able to underbid on compliant businesses because they have savings for cost. So they get the bids opposed to people who do comply. And we also find that licensees are typically a group that don't have a high percentage of third-party reporting. They're often self-employed. And in our tax compliance report we talked about in 2009, we talked about how important it was for third-party reporting, W-2s and 1099s. Of course, third-party reporting is highest on wage earners, and we have less than half of 50% compliance on self-employed. So in 2009, in part, I think, based on that report, you folks authorized House Bill 3082, which allowed us to start evaluating whether licensee compliance was a good idea, was a good tool. We narrowed the focus initially. It was just for individuals, individual income tax, so no business taxes. And the bill authorized us to work with three different licensing agencies where the licensee's license was in jeopardy of being suspended or revoked. We looked at three different boards, the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, the Construction Contractors Board, and the Board of Tax Practitioners, checked about 6,200 licenses, and found, I think, about a really big bulk of them were from the Board of Tax Practitioners. And as you can see, we actively engaged them during 2009. Let me back up a little bit. 2009 and 2010, we actively engaged the licensees through the boards, and we talked to them about education and their risk of losing their license. And that's contained in, I think, the appendix for the original report we gave to you about House Bill 3082.
And that's in OLIS today.
It is in OLIS. And a lot of this is also in OLIS from the 2013 regular session under House Bill 2871. A lot of the meeting materials for that are relevant to this report. In 2011 and 12, we really worked just on an educational basis, and that was our Phase 2 report, also in OLIS from 2013 regular session. And then in 2013, we did not engage with the licensees. So what we learned, as you can see from this report, is that as of, you know, in column A, our baseline compliance was, like for the mortuary board, 84.2%. As we were actively engaged with them, it increased to 91.1%. But as we stopped working with them and the threat of not having a sanction for not being in tax compliance, recidivism went back to 86.1%. So it was a pretty good rate there. And so we believe that there is value in expanding the pilot project under 3082, because it appears that the highest rate of compliance occurs when the licensee is at risk of losing his or her license for being out of tax compliance. One of the things that in House Bill 2871 that you asked about was how would you phase in something like, how would you create something like that? And what we found as we were preparing this report is that we really don't have a good understanding of what the universe of licensees is. And I think that's part of what we struggled with last session. The information is limited that is out there, and it's often out of date or inaccurate. So I also learned in 2013 that House Bill 2643 created an Oregon license directory. It's administered by the Secretary of State, and agencies are required to put the number of licenses and the number of licensees on that website available as of, I think the first reporting is September of this year. So we expect that information will get better. So we would hope that eventually we would be able to land on a recommendation on how you could implement this, whether it's occupational licenses or recreational licenses or what the count of each are. We also want to leverage technology. We think that automating any kind of a licensee compliance process would be best, where they can come to our website, self-service portal, and, you know, print out a document that says, yes, you're in compliance, or no, we're not in compliance, depending on how many people would be subject to this requirement. Additionally, as you know, we also have a new core system replacement, which we believe is going to provide us with better compliance tools and or new compliance tools and better data. So hopefully we can come back with some better information about the effectiveness or how to implement such a requirement. So our recommendation at this point would be to allow House Bill 3082 to sunset. It sunsets in 2016, which is right in the middle of our implementation of our new GenTech system, and revisit it in the future. Once our system is fully implemented and the Oregon License Directory is updated with better information, we think that that will give us enough time to examine our compliance strategies in light of the emerging technology and accurate licensee information, so and give us ability to weigh benefits associated with licensee compliance against other tools we may have. With that, if you have any questions.
Thank you. Questions? I have one.
Yes.
And this may be something you need to tell us later. I don't know. When do you expect that the core systems work will be far enough along so that this compliance process could be added into that system?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is the personal income tax program is rolling out in phase two, 2015 to 2016. I think our phase three is, I believe everything is supposed to be done around 2017-ish. Mm-hmm. I'll give a little squish there because I'm not 100% sure on that number. But after that, so it's right, it'd be after the current 3082 expires.
So it would be for 17, for the tax year 17, which reports in 18?
Correct.
Or the tax year 16, which reports in 17? Or do you know?
Mr. Chair, we haven't really thought about how much time we would want to take. I think the first reporting for the licensee database is September of this year. I don't know how much information there would be in there. We'd need time to be able to analyze it and see how many licensees are in there. I don't know if there's a phase-in for that bill or not, but definitely at least a year to be able to look at, you know, and give you some sort of a good recommendation on how to implement it.
Great. Well, I have no idea what the legislature next year would prefer, but I would ask you to put it on your tickle sheet, your list for of things to do, to be prepared to answer that question next year again. And I have to tell you, my preference is to pass a bill next year that sets up the system, even if it is a couple of years out, rather than simply allowing a sunset. But we very much appreciate your report. Does that raise any other comments or thoughts? Thank you very much. We appreciate your report, and we'll ask the committee to review it and read it, and we may have other questions for you later.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thanks. Chris?
Paul's going to handle the next
one. Paul's going to handle the next one. Okay.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The next report from the Department of Revenue is on out-of-state tax shelters. Uh-huh. This was a part of House Bill 2460, which went through a number of different forms, as you recall, last session. But it was the bill in which contained the tax haven designation and requiring the Department of Revenue to report income, or requiring taxpayers report income that was attributed to those tax haven areas. But the bill itself, 2460, also had another element to it, and that was the requirement of a report from Department of Revenue on out-of-state tax shelters in general. And that report is in OLIS. They provided that to us right before the session started. And Jeff Henderson here from the Corporate Division has done the work on it, and he also was helped us a lot in developing the other parts of 2460 as well, the tax haven fees.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning.
This is the one I think of as the Duchy of Grand Liechtenstein, or Grand Duchy of Liechtenstein bill, but
right.
People may refer to it different ways. Please, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Henderson. I am the Corporation Tax Policy Coordinator at the Oregon Department of Revenue. As Paul indicated here today, to go over the out-of-state tax shelters report that was required by House Bill 2460 from the 13 regular session. My plan today is just to go quickly through the report and identify the methods discuss the methods that the department has identified as used by corporations to shift income otherwise taxable outside of the state, and then answer any questions that you may have. Please jump in and stop me, though, if questions come up. The focus of this report is on corporation income tax shelters, and it's limited to transactions with related corporations. I think there was a lot of potential areas this could have gone with shelters, but this was the focus of it for corporations and transactions with related corporations. The report is divided into two categories: international tax shelters that impact both federal and state tax liabilities. Specifically for Oregon, that's due to our connection to federal taxable income and the federal filing method, which includes only those corporations that are located inside the United States. And then also domestic U.S. tax shelters that primarily just impact state tax liabilities. The report also addresses both abusive and legitimate tax shelters and points out that there's a fine line between the two, but the tax implications are very different. Abusive tax shelters are illegal and potentially subject to greater penalties, whereas legitimate shelters are statutorily allowed and viewed as effective tax planning. And so it just points out that there's a fine line between the two. Jumping into international tax shelters, The obvious objective for multinational corporations that do business globally is to minimize tax liability. And for those multinational corporations, one way to accomplish this is to structure business activities so that the maximum amount of profits are reported in the low tax or no tax jurisdictions, and then maximize the amount of expenses allocated to the high tax jurisdictions, arguably like the United States. International tax shelters are not realistically available to all corporations. Limited to just those corporations, large multi-state, large multinational corporations that have the resources to establish an affiliate in a foreign jurisdiction. Quickly, a little background on the federal tax provisions. U.S. corporations are subject to U.S. tax on all income, including the income earned abroad. U.S.-based multinational corporations generally, however, can defer tax earned from a controlled foreign corporation. So that would be a corporation that they have a direct ownership interest in. So they can defer income earned through a controlled foreign corporation until that income is brought back to the United States, repatriated in the form of a dividend. Deferral is, however, generally prohibited on passive income. Inherently mobile income, that could include dividends, interest, royalties, under the subpart F provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. International tax shelters have received significant attention recently in the headlines, focusing on the large profits that are being stored, maintained offshore. Specifically, in March of 2013, the Wall Street Journal reported an analysis that they did on 60 SEC filings for 60 large U.S.-based multinationals. The Wall Street Journal found that the 60 businesses maintained a combined total of $166 billion in profits for 2012 alone offshore. It reported the trend was most pronounced amongst the 26 technology and healthcare companies that were part of that study, stating that many tech and healthcare companies have shifted intellectual property, the inherently mobile property, offshore, such as patents and marketing rights to subsidiaries in low-tax countries, allowing the sales and profits to be recorded in the low-tax jurisdictions. The analysis showed those 26 corporations reported $120 billion of profits overseas alone, accounted for nearly three-quarters of the total. The report did not, however, of the profits that identified as being maintained offshore, it didn't provide a breakdown of what percentage would be attributable to abusive shelters. In general, the report kind of looked at these transactions as transactions that are allowed under Internal Revenue Code. The Osberg Foundation released a report in 2013 that also addressed the revenue impact of offshore tax havens used by U.S. corporations. The report estimated that Oregon loses $283 million in corporate revenues annually to offshore tax havens. Once again, that report, though, also did not provide a breakdown of what slice of that would be attributable to abusive tax shelters. The U.S. Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations undertook a two-part study and released its findings from that study in 2012 and 2013. It was a review of the offshore tax avoidance schemes used by three of the largest U.S.-based multinational corporations. It was Microsoft, Hewlett-Packard, and Apple. The subcommittee identified provisions in the existing provisions in the code that allowed these corporations to, one, shift intellectual property and profits offshore to a related affiliate in a low-tax or no-tax foreign jurisdiction, in part to avoid reduce its U.S. taxes on profits generated by these intangible assets. Two, it allowed these companies to defer U.S. taxation on offshore passive income that's generally prohibited under the subpart F provisions from being deferred, but they pointed to exceptions in the code that allowed for that deferral of the passive income. And finally, they pointed to provisions in the code that allowed these corporations to effectively repatriate foreign profits back to the U.S. to run U.S. operations without subjecting those foreign profits to U.S. tax through a short-term loan exception. The specific international transactions identified by the U.S. Senate case study, again, were not labeled as abusive, but rather referred to generally as transactions allowed under federal law. However, there was written testimony submitted during part of that process that suggests some of the specific transactions reviewed as part of the study appeared on the surface to conflict with common law doctrines. So moving into that, anti-abuse common law doctrines, again, the line between abusive and legitimate tax shelters is often unclear, and unless a transaction is found to conflict with a specific statutory provision, the determining factor often falls to a review of the transaction under anti-abuse common law doctrines. Anti-abuse common law doctrines for tax law purposes have been created by the courts and traced back to the 1930s. These doctrines are used to evaluate transactions where the language of the law does not directly address a specific scenario or where a scenario is addressed, but there is a question as to whether the transaction complies with the purpose of the statute. Historically, there are three common judicial doctrines that the IRS has used to address transactions that produce unreasonable or unwarranted tax benefits. One, the substance over form doctrine. Second, the business purpose doctrine. And finally, the economic substance doctrine. Briefly, the impact of abusive tax shelters on Oregon corporate revenues. The department was not able to determine what that impact is. Undoubtedly, there is an impact, but because there is such a fine line between abusive and legitimate, I mean, it would take a detailed analysis of each transaction to determine whether or not it was abusive. Moving into the domestic tax shelters, the shelters addressed in the report involve transactions with unitary affiliates and that are oftentimes incorporated in a tax haven state, such as Delaware, Nevada, or Wyoming. Nevada and Wyoming do not impose a corporate income tax, and Delaware does impose a corporate income tax. However, it does not tax the income of a corporation whose only activity in the state is the ownership, maintenance, and management of intangible assets. So those are appealing locations for multi-state corporations to establish an affiliate, and so that the transactions in this report focus on those. Two of the domestic tax shelter strategies that rely on the creation of an affiliate listed in the report are passive investment companies, otherwise known as referred to as a trademark holding company, and asset management companies. The passive investment company strategy typically involves the transferring of an operating company's trademark or trade name to an affiliate, which then licenses the trademarks back to the operating company for a royalty. So the subsidiaries often incorporate in a state like Nevada or Wyoming, which doesn't have a corporate income tax, or Delaware, and the operating company is entitled to a royalty expense deduction. So for the use of the trademarks. Asset management company, similar to the passive investment company arrangement, the asset management company strategy involves transactions with a related affiliate. A common transaction typically involves a transfer of an income-producing asset, such as a mortgage-backed security from a financial institution, as part of a loan participation agreement, to a unitary affiliate incorporated in a tax haven state. For Oregon purposes, if the asset management company is not included in the same federal return, the interest income from that asset would be removed effectively from the Oregon tax base. If that asset management company is included in the federal return and in the Oregon return, the income would remain in the base, but there would be an impact, potential impact to the apportionment percentage. The income that asset management company would generate from property in the state of Oregon, which would be sourced to Oregon by the corporation, is now being sourced to the state where the asset management company is located. So, very briefly, those are the methods identified by the department.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for all the work on this. Is there a recommendation that you're making, or maybe a better way of putting this? Osberg said we're losing $200 and some odd million a year. I don't know how they reached that conclusion. Can you share with us your thought on whether they're anywhere close, and if so, what we should be doing about it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, maybe LRO staff could speak better to where Osberg, where they came up with that $283 million annual estimate for corporate revenues. I'm not sure. I'm thinking it's probably from the, you know, for publicly traded corporations, the SEC filings. They can look and see what kind of profits are being maintained offshore. Those are reported on those filings. And then back into a computation of what the tax results could look like. It's difficult because then they'd have to make some pretty big estimates on apportionment percentages. But as far as recommendations there, House Bill 2460, there was a provision in there that provided the department shall make recommendations for noncompliance attributable to out-of-state tax shelters. And so for the noncompliance piece, there were recommendations included, I believe, towards the back of the report. The recommendations was uniformity with federal provisions to the extent that, you know, there's some anti-abuse federal legislation that's out there now, to the extent that that legislation didn't impact taxable income and there wasn't a tie for Oregon. Felt that would be something that for the committees to consider. And also, there was a provision in there to a recommendation to consider codifying the economic substance common law doctrine in statute. That is an approach other states have taken, and also the IRS has taken that approach and codified that in statute. There's been some split interpretations of how that common law doctrine is to be applied, whether it's a single prong or a two prong approach, and other states and the IRS have codified that it is a two prong approach that the taxpayer would have to show there's a valid business purpose for the transaction. So those are the recommendations made as part of this.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vance, please.
So yeah, I saw those, and they looked like they were all standard driven devices, so you would place these standards into law, and then what would happen? That's really my question, because does that then mean that if we had these standards, people would suddenly start paying their taxes? So
that's an excellent question, Representative Bence.
That is a great question, Mr. Chair. Representative Bence, looking at those separately, I suppose to the extent there are federal provisions that come out of anti-abuse proposed legislation now that would be increased penalties, something that would maybe discourage corporations from undertaking some abusive transactions. Maybe we'd see some of that directly as far as the recommendation to codify common law doctrine and statute. I think that it wouldn't change the tools that the department currently uses when analyzing returns. Those are tools that are currently used, but for that recommendation specifically, there's just been some split opinions by the courts in applying that common law doctrine, and so the IRS and other states have taken an approach to clarify that it is a two-pronged test that needs to be, I guess, cleared by the taxpayer.
Follow up,
please.
Thank you. So we're getting closer to the focus of my question, which is you get the standards in place and you do have the tools necessary to see if they are complying with those standards, or you need more tools, or are you saying that the information is there but the standards aren't? I have this thought that we could put the standards in place but not have the tools to know whether or not they're being met.
I see. Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, I apologize for the confusion on that. I do understand your question, and I think it would be a sharpening of a tool. I think realistically, when you look at these transactions that are abusive shelters that are identified in the report, the report talks about some of the IRS actions, what they've taken to address some of these international tax shelters. And it is kind of a catch-up game. I mean, it's these transactions happen, and it takes some time for the taxing authorities to catch up to that and look at these transactions, determine which ones are abusive, and make adjustments. There is citations in the report from the current IRS activities, and they talk about how many cases they currently have involving some of these international tax sheltering activities and the potential revenue for adjustment that's out there. For Oregon purposes, the department does receive audit reports from the IRS. And likewise with the IRS, the department would be just, it's an education process, becoming familiar with transactions, and just becoming familiar with it. So the profits that are being maintained offshore, gaining recent attention, and it's just taking time for the taxing authorities, I guess, to look that direction and become familiar with identifying abusive transactions.
Final follow-up.
Yes, please.
So it's a matter of Oregon following the federal folk. Is that what we're doing? Or are we out there on our own and they're following? Who's going first?
It sounds like the IRS has, Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, the IRS has put considerable effort into this. Again, it's cited in the report. I would think the IRS is ahead of the game from where Oregon is at with this. Our tie to federal taxable income, in part, we do rely on the IRS efforts. We tie to the definition of federal taxable income. So any changes made on that end, we will utilize their audit efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? I was listening to your rendition of how companies manage to keep profits offshore. When you started talking about the limitations on passive income, it occurred to me that one of the effects of doing this may very well be to encourage them to invest actively offshore, simply because if they repatriate the money, they end up having to pay taxes to the federal government on it first. So even a smaller rate of return offshore might actually make them more money than the net amount that they would have to invest in the United States after paying the taxes on it. So in some senses, this, if I've analyzed this correctly, in some senses, this way of managing offshore profits, not only does it cost the government's dollars in terms of taxes, but it may also have a negative impact on investment in the United States as compared with other places. Do you think I've analyzed that correctly, at least part of the time?
Mr. Chair, I agree with you. I do think you've analyzed that correctly. So there are provisions in place to prevent maintaining profits from passive income offshore. But as the U.S. Senate case study, their findings just showed that there were clear exceptions in the current IRC that allow for those profits to be maintained offshore. It could absolutely have impact on U.S. operations, but at the same time, they identified some provisions that are allowing them to repatriate funds back to the U.S. to run operations,
right,
and still avoid tax.
And ironically, those provisions may actually help, given that we're going to allow them not to pay taxes on their offshore income. From an economic point of view, I suspect. I mean, with these giant amounts of profits that are sitting offshore, I assume that has at least a marginal impact on the cost of capital offshore as compared to in the United States, although, of course, right now, because of the recession, capital doesn't cost anything. But in normal times, it would actually make a difference.
Sure. I agree with you.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the report. Needless to say, you've given us a number of things to think about. I've already asked, Revenue Office to get going on drafting based on your recommendations. So expect to hear from them on that issue. And, of course, we have no idea whether we're going to do anything or not. But certainly this legislature won't, but perhaps the next one will. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
And I think we're going to, given the hour, we're going to hold over the highway report for another day. And there's nothing else for the Revenue Committee that we have to do today.
Right. Mr. Chair, just a couple things.
Yes, please.
I would say about the out-of-state tax shelter report, I think it's something that has some very good background information on combined reporting, on apportionment. And given that we're anticipating some new members in 15, I think we'll keep this as a part of our orientation material. But the other thing I'd like to...
oh, goody.
They'll love that.
I'd like to... yes, it's amazing. Right?
We will find out whether the new members can hack this committee.
That's right.
Yes.
It's a test. but the other thing, we are also working on another House bill for you, and so we will hope to have that ready soon. So we would ask you to stay alert for a possible work session.
Oh, thank you. And that is a very, very, very good point. I think the reference is to two bills that we actually heard earlier in the session, and it's possible. I'm going to hold the meeting open then.
Our sense is it would be tomorrow.
You think it's tomorrow? Yeah. Okay. Well, be prepared for a very late notice on a work session tomorrow morning. And if we hold that work session, I'm guessing it's a half an hour work session, wouldn't you? So 9 or 9:30.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If it is a morning work session and there's any way to know tonight by 7 or 8 or 9, it's helpful to know that so that transportation here starts on time.
And if members are interested in that, please advise the LRO where you can be reached at that hour. Either by email or by phone, so that they have an easy time to make that notice. All right. Anything else? So you don't believe there's any value in recessing for today. All right. Well, in that case, you're off the hook. We'll adjourn the meeting for today, and we'll see you hopefully tomorrow. That committee's adjourned.